This is the intersection of politics and culture. My name is Mark Riley, and thank you so much for listening to this podcast. We're going to start out on this episode talking about climate change. Now, I don't know about you, but I was one of those people for a very, very, very long time, until actually pretty recently, who thought about climate change like this. Yeah, we have to do something about it. Yeah, it's important, but I don't know what to do, therefore I'm not going to pay that much attention. And I think most people, even progressive people, live their lives saying, yeah, climate change and addressing it is a good thing, and we need to do that, and we need to do that fairly soon. But there's always been a laid-back element, I think, in terms of progressive support for addressing climate change. I'm not sure our hearts have totally been in it. As we now have a Green New Deal, which has been championed by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the House of Representatives and Edward Markey from Massachusetts in the Senate, we now have a blueprint to do something. And we'll get into momentarily the response to the blueprint. But I think it's really important to set out a few facts here. And this is why I have taken on a different attitude and a different perspective about climate change. The UN recently put out a report which had some, for me, troubling statistics. For example, the past 4 years have been the warmest on record, globally speaking. The warmest years on record have been during 20 of the past 22 years, all but two. More and more people and more governments are starting to see climate change as a national security issue. And yet we have people in the United States, including people at the very top of our political food chain, who still want to debate, who still want to argue, who still want to toe, I guess, the money line on climate change, which is we don't really have to do a whole heck of a lot about it right now. Now, who is the leader of that money train? The fossil fuel industry. We, in fact, in this country, take 80%, consume 80% of our energy from fossil fuels. 80%. Is that sustainable? Is it sustainable, for example, for our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren? I submit the answer to that question is no, absolutely not. We cannot sustain 80% of our energy coming from fossil fuels for the next 100 years. It won't work. It simply will not work. And we will be, if we don't act now, leaving a planet for our successors that is far worse than what we have had and what was left to us by our predecessors. And yet, people still want to argue. People still want to stall. People still, for example, think that we don't really have to get serious about cleaning up our environment. And we do have now the Green New Deal, which is a serious attempt to put climate change on the front burner and actually do something about it. Now, some people will argue that implementing the Green New Deal, or anything like it for that matter, and there are a lot of conflicting reports about what it entails. I'm not going to get into that here. The cost factor has, and it's interesting that the cost factor for healthcare and the cost factor for the Green New Deal seem to be roughly the same depending on whose estimates you believe, somewhere on the order of $3 trillion. All right, now, we'll talk about healthcare on another day, but let's say for the sake of argument that it's true that implementing the Green New Deal as quickly as possible is going to cost the government $3 trillion. And that's a lot of money. And if you point it to the average American and say, that's how much it's going to cost, they're going to turn around and say, what are you out of your mind? It's too much money. It costs too much. However, everything in this life I've found is relative. Since September 11, 2001, the United States has spent $6 trillion on wars. Wars all over the planet. That's right, $6 trillion. Enough to pay for the Green New Deal twice. And here's the thing that I find very interesting, and I believe AOC brought this up. When there's a war, nobody talks about the cost. When was the last time you heard the United States, or for that matter, any other government that's gone to war, say, sorry, we can't go to war because it costs too much money. We can't do this because it's too expensive. And the fact of the matter is, the next time you hear that will be the first time you'll hear that. We do not generally prosecute wars based on how much they cost, or do we pay any attention whatsoever as to how much they cost. Yet, when it comes to something as basic as cleaning our environment, making it better for ourselves and those who come in front of us, that costs too much money. That we cannot do. And I find it fascinating on a certain level that we really, really have to ask ourselves some hard questions. Like, for example, we say we love our children. I have to ask, do we love them enough to change how we live? And right now, that answer is no. And our kids know this. Our kids understand this. If we as elders don't recognize the dangers of climate change, trust me, our kids are going to drag us headfirst into that revelation, kicking and screaming if need be. Now, I find it also interesting that the Green New Deal is not just about addressing climate change. There are other things that it wants to address. It mandates job training. It mandates new economic development, particularly to communities and in communities that now rely on fossil fuels for jobs. Now, I have to say, some of the criticisms of the Green New Deal are laughable. They would be in a comedy if they didn't come from elected officials who apparently believe this crap. For example, and they're serious about this. That's the amazing thing. They talk about the fact that it may mean the end of cheeseburgers and milkshakes. And it may mean electric trains running on unicorn tears, high-speed rail running on unicorn tears. This is from elected officials. I didn't make this stuff up. And I have to ask the question, why are these people so nervous that they would demonize the whole idea of the Green New Deal and would demonize, in particular, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Why would they demonize her in this way? I mean, she certainly come into Congress and swung a rather big stick, probably as big a stick as anybody who's been a freshman legislator has ever thrown or has ever handled. And they're coming after her over Amazon. That's a New York City situation. But in this case, I am convinced that the reason why folks try to trivialize the Green New Deal has to do with fear, has to do with nervousness, has to do with the notion that this Green New Deal will mean a change in the way people live their lives. A change. Electric cars, for example, where now we use gasoline-powered cars, and hybrids. Hybrids was and is a good thing and is a good idea, but it's not enough, ladies and gentlemen. And the people in the fossil fuel industry know that. The more we start using electricity and other available sources of energy and not have to depend on fossil fuels means their bank gets bent. They eventually will go broke. And they know it. And they fight against it. And they fight against it the only way they know how, with their money. Ever since the Citizens United decision in 2010, and even back before that, moneyed interests connected to the fossil fuel industry have been pouring money into the coffers of friendly politicians, people who will do and say and act precisely as they want because they're looking to maintain. And some of these people, these are not kids, all right? They're not young people. They're older folks. Some of them are in their 60s, 70s, whatever. But they cannot stomach the idea that the world they created, a world dependent on fossil fuels, a world that has, for them, made them extraordinarily rich over a very long period of time. They can't stomach the idea that that world not just will change, but that that world has to change. And it's frightening to them. Even if they're not going to be here for it, it frightens them. And I say, fine, not a problem. Let it frighten them. Because it's time that we take seriously the idea of having to change how we live. And, you know, that starts with me. It's not something that I'm talking about in the abstract. I have to start thinking to myself, how can I change how I live so I am less dependent on fossil fuels? You know, when I lived in Manhattan, it was relatively easy because I didn't have a car. And I just jumped on the train and went where I wanted to go. And that left a very small footprint as far as energy was concerned, energy use was concerned. But we still, and by the way, now that I don't live in the city anymore, my footprint has gotten a bit larger because I got two cars. One of which is my daughter's, by the way. Don't think I'm just running around with two cars because I want to be ostentatious or something. But we have to start the process of shrinking that footprint. Just like we have to eat better, just like we have to be healthier, just like we have to look out for other people's health, in my judgment, we are also going to have to look at our own individual environmental footprint very, very differently. Because if we don't, by the end of this century, it will be hell on earth. It's possible that some of our coastal cities will be completely underwater. Let me say that again. It is possible that some of our coastal cities will be completely and utterly underwater. Why? Because the world is getting warmer. Now, every time there's a snowstorm on the East Coast, okay, people, climate change deniers jump up and say, what are you talking about? Look at it, it's cold outside. What's wrong with you people? You're out of your minds. Ignore the foolishness. Ignore the hype, because that's exactly what it is. The fact of the matter is the world, not just New York, not just the East Coast, the world is getting warmer. And it has implications. I don't care if the world is getting warmer and you live in the coldest place on earth. The implications are coming. And they're coming, and they will devastate the lives of people that we say we love. Our kids, our grandkids, our great-grandkids, our great-great-grandkids. And history will judge us harshly for knowing that climate change needs to be addressed and not doing anything about it. So next time people tell you that the Green New Deal is fairyland or fantasy land or whatever, ask them how much they think it's worth to spend on a war. And ask them if it makes sense to them, that we opt out of a war because we can't afford it. Because we cannot, in my humble judgment, opt out of addressing climate change because we can't afford it. We have got to afford it. This is The Intersection. And when we come back, I'm going to talk about something that kind of touches me personally. It's called Millennial Wanderlust. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for tuning in. Send me an email, mark@markreillymedia.com. Or if you have a topic you'd like me to cover, email me at mark@markreillymedia.com. Back in a flash. Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Reilly, and we are so glad you're with us. Our next segment deals with something that is, on a certain level, very personal to me, and I have to kind of set it up just a little bit. My father, who worked for 40 years in the post office and then did another 15 years working in a hospital, was a person who really never got a chance to do some of the things I believe he always wanted to do. One of those things was to fly. My father never flew in an airplane throughout his 87 years. And he was born the year after Kitty Hawk, when the Wright brothers first flew a plane in this country. My dad, toward the end of his life, used to do something that at first perplexed me, but then became really, really clear in terms of his reasons and his motivation. He was living in suburban Washington, and at least one day a week, he would call a cab, and that cab would take him to the airport, one of the airports in the DC area. And he would sit in the parking lot as close to a runway as he possibly could, and he would watch airplanes take off and land. And he would do this for a couple hours, you know, once a week. Just take off and land. And, you know, the cab company, got to know him well. Because as soon as he was done, as soon as he had sated this desire to watch air travel, he would just have the cab take him back home. And it struck me that for him, my family's ability, his children's ability to travel around the world must have made him pretty happy. My older brother Clayton, who was stationed in Germany during his time in the service, my younger brother Norman, who traveled as Harry Belafonte's stage manager, I've been able to travel as a journalist, gone to inaugurations, gone to various places in the world. We've all been able to travel. We've all been on airplanes. And I've always kind of felt, I don't want to say guilty, but just a little bit sad that my father never had the ability to do what I ended up doing. Now, for me, when I was young, you know, because a lot of my travel, I didn't even get on an airplane until I was 27 years old. So for a long time, travel to me meant getting on the train and going from 170th Street in the Bronx out to Coney Island in Brooklyn or East New York in Brooklyn. Now, fast forward to 2019. Young people, I'm convinced, and this is anecdotal on my part, but young people, including my daughter, seem to have caught cases of wanderlust that my generation could really only dream of. And I think it may be part of the reason why there is this apparent gulf between the baby boom generation and millennials. They do certain things that we simply do not understand. My daughter, unlike me, I mean, I've been to a few places, but my daughter studied abroad for two successive semesters at college, traveled throughout Europe, and studied in South Africa during that period of time. She now wants to visit Southeast Asia. And trust me, she is not alone among young people. My daughter's going to be 22 years old soon. At my job, there was a young woman who worked in the research department. Brilliant young lady. I asked about her the other day because I hadn't seen her, and I was told that she quit. And I asked if she had gone to another job, and the answer was no. This young lady wanted to travel. She figures she'll get another job when she's finished traveling. She wants to experience the world. In a way, by the way, that I'm not sure my generation or even, you know, the Generation Xers and a few others, I don't think we've had that kind of curiosity. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. Are we witnessing millennial wanderlust? And if so, why? Is it because younger people are curious about the way other people live? I think if that's true, that more people are traveling outside the U.S., it has, first of all, my applause, but it also has profound implications for the future of this country. Think about this for a moment. In 1998, just 20, 21 years ago, about 42 million Americans had valid passports. Last year, in 2018, that number stood at 137 million passports. And even then, 64% of residents do not have a valid passport, which means they can't travel outside the United States. So what does it mean that three times the number of people have passports as had them just 20 years ago? I believe it means many more people are experiencing other cultures, other ways of being. And maybe, just maybe, they'll come home with an empathy for social and economic factors that produce their own lives and the lives of the people they come in contact with. And, you know, again, my evidence of this millennial thing, younger people wanting to travel, is anecdotal. What is factual is this huge number of people and the increase in the number of people who have valid passports. I remember when people used to say, well, it's only like 3 or 5% of the American people actually have these passports. What it does do is enable people to go to, if I look at my circle of friends and ask them, like, where have they been over the last 5 years, the numbers are boggling in terms of the places they've been. And, you know, I'm not part of the millennial generation. But it appears as though millennials have kind of split themselves up into those who want to travel and those who don't. And those who want to travel can't quite figure out why those who don't have no interest in going to other places. Now, the other part of this is that there's a lot of places you can travel inside the United States. You know, it's a 5-6 hour trip from New York to California. If you've never been to California, and I've talked to a few people recently who have never been to California, it's a trip worth taking, in my judgment. I mean, I love California. Just as importantly, I love what California stands for politically, but that's another point. I exchanged emails recently with a guy I knew when I was very small and had stumbled on his name quite by accident. And it turns out that after apparently a pretty long career, 35, 40 years, working in IT and doing this and doing that. He had gone to Dartmouth. He went to Stanford. And he was, I guess, maybe a systems analyst, something like that. And after apparently a pretty productive life doing that, he turned around and decided he wanted to be a photographer. And I looked at some of his pictures. They were absolutely breathtaking, absolutely breathtaking. He concentrates on the West Coast of the U.S., but he also travels. He goes to Croatia. He went to, ironically enough, some of the same places my daughter went to in Eastern Europe. And he takes these absolutely stunning photographs. And I think that this connects with what I'm talking about in the first place, because I believe that when younger people in particular get a chance to see castles or rock formations or anything that is out of their wheelhouse as far as their own personal experience, I think it drives them to say, you know what, I do want to see this. I know when my daughter was in South Africa, she went on an excursion to the Kruger National Park and, you know, kind of roughed it for a few days, roughed it in a way I never thought she would be capable of doing. But she did, because she was curious, because she wants to see. Now, her next stop, I guess, if that's what she chooses to do, is to go to Southeast Asia. She wants to see how people live there. What is their reality? Maybe she'll get a chance to ride in a 200-mile-an-hour high-speed train, something you won't get a chance to do here. I think the top out for the Acela, which is Amtrak's fastest train, is something on the order of, 125, 130 miles an hour. Well, you can go to, and it's interesting, you go to China and find trains that run like way, way, way faster than that. And I'm thinking that, you know, this means that there is a seismic change taking place among our youth. They are not going to look at the world the way we look at the world. They are not going to perhaps sit still for certain things that we sat still for because we couldn't figure out a way to make the change that was necessary to make those things different. And they appear to be, and you know, again, I could be wrong. They could end up being just like us. I hope not, but I think they could be. But I believe, and maybe it's just like a hope on my part, that they won't be just like us. That there will come a time when they will begin to change the world through travel, through understanding other cultures, and realizing that war, in particular, is not the way to deal with other cultures, not even to deal with cultures that you might be in conflict with. To me, that's like an old mindset now. Certainly, it's existed my entire life. And I think it's time to change. And more power to you, millennials, if that wanderlust ends you up. You know, because some people will travel and, like, not come home. They'll stay in a place as long as they can. And if they find a way to get permanent residence or some kind of citizenship, they'll do that. And I say more power to them as well. And for those who don't have passports, for those who have never left the United States, you might want to give it a try. I understand it's difficult sometimes. You know, when I was in Paris, not knowing a lot of French, and one thing I can tell you, the French people that I ran into expected that you'd know something coming from the United States. They would expect that you know some kind of French or some way to communicate that doesn't require them to communicate with you in English. And, you know, you kind of get to know certain quirks about other populations, other countries. But you can't really learn about these things until you go and experience them. You can't experience looking at the Arc de Triomphe simply through a photograph. It is an awe-inspiring thing to see, like, right in front of you. Eiffel Tower, same thing. Tower of London, same thing. Kruger National Park, same thing. And at some point, you might get to really appreciate what other places have to offer. So my message maybe is for people who are not millennials, who don't think about travel. And Part of the reason why folks can travel easier now is because the cost of airfares have at least leveled off and in some cases declined, so that it's not that difficult to make these trips. If you get a chance, and I'm not talking about getting necessarily on a cruise ship or going to a tourist destination, go somewhere and enjoy yourself. Go somewhere and learn about other people. We've got one more segment left, and we're going to talk about, it was a question about whether or not it'd be Justin Smollett or R. Kelly. I ended up choosing R. Kelly. So stay with us. This is The Intersection. I'd love to hear from you at my Facebook page, Mark Riley Media. Stay with us.
Conversation at Mark Riley Media on Facebook.
Welcome back to The Intersection. Glad you're listening to the podcast. Thank you so much for doing so. For updates, like my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Our third segment has to do with R. Kelly. R. Kelly has never been like a favorite of mine. I'm talking about musically now. I'm not talking about his conduct or any of the allegations against him. I've just never been into him. However, I did meet him once. It was in the early 1990s, and Aaliyah, a great singer who left us way, way too soon, was on a promotional tour, and I did an interview with her. And R. Kelly was with her at the time. And, I mean, first of all, she looked, like, really young. She looked like a kid. But I knew that she had a set of pipes because I had heard some of her music. Even though it might not have been my root music, I had heard it. I respected it. I liked some of the stuff she did. So she and R. Kelly are sitting at an interview table. He did not speak during the course of the interview. But it was clear that she kind of sort of took direction from him in terms of her answers to some of my questions. And, you know, when you interview a music person, my end game is usually to get them to talk about their art, talk about their craft, and talk about how they come to create the music that they do. Now, I didn't realize at the time how young she was. But when you ask a kid that age how they do those things, it might be a little difficult for them to kind of put all that into words. So it, you know, didn't surprise me that she would kind of look up at him. And at times he would like mouth certain phrases or whatever. And she was, you know, she appeared to be cool. It was a good interview. But as it turns out now, when we fast forward to 2019, R. Kelly has been indicted on 10 counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse involving four women, three of whom are allegedly 17 or younger. If convicted on all counts, R. Kelly could end up spending the rest of his life in prison. He spent at least one night in jail after he couldn't post 10% of his $1 million bond over the weekend. Now, those are the facts of R. Kelly's case, both real and alleged. And as I said, I met him. And I remember after R. Kelly and Aaliyah were in studio, there were rumors that, you know, she was young. She was younger than, you know, people thought she was. And that the two of them were, in fact, married, which you could have blown me over with a hard breath of air, because I'm thinking to myself, you know, I didn't know how old R. Kelly was. I know now he's 52. But he must have been like in his late 20s, early 30s back then. And I just, the idea that he would have married this young lady is just, at the time, was like, what? Nah, couldn't be. couldn't be. He's not like that, is he? But then there were persistent and subsequent rumors about R. Kelly's conduct. And, you know, the center of the rumors were that he had a thing for young girls because his marriage to Aaliyah was annulled by her parents, who she didn't bother getting permission from, in 1995. And on the marriage certificate, because I think they got married at a hotel in Illinois someplace, it said she was 18. So she lied on that. So R. Kelly was then free to do whatever he, I guess, chose to do. And, you know, the word around the business, as it were, was that he liked young girls. And then there were videos that came out and, you know, a lot of stuff. But I have to say, I am absolutely stunned by the loyalty of R. Kelly's fans. And I'm not talking about like, you know, when this recent documentary came out, which we'll talk about. But I'm talking about going back to when these rumors first started, toward the end of the 90s, into the early 21st century. R. Kelly had hit after hit after hit, singles and albums. His fan base was loyal even after that video came out. Now, in 2002, he had a bit of a problem because he was indicted and later acquitted on 21 counts of child pornography based on those tapes, which he apparently denied it was him in many cases. Then later on, his brother went public with the statement that R. Kelly offered him $50,000 in order to say it was him and not R. Kelly on the tape, which is like really dumb if that's what he did. By the way, he was first indicted in 2002. That case didn't conclude until 2008, and he was acquitted on all charges. So his popularity did not wane during that time. But then, as the Me Too movement got started, people started and began again casting an eye at R. Kelly. What are these rumors? You know, and see, I don't know how people do this, but you make tapes of you having sex with an underage girl, allegedly. That makes abso-freaking-lutely no sense to me whatsoever. But then this 6-part documentary comes out, Surviving R. Kelly. And suddenly the wheels started to come off. You know, there were people who erased duets they had done with him. I think Lady Gaga may have been one of them. And that happened before the doc came out. But people in the business started disassociating themselves. He got dropped by his record label, bunch of stuff. But then the documentary comes out. Now, the documentary, which was 6 parts, rehashed, however you want to describe it, certain allegations against R. Kelly, including the allegations that he was tried and acquitted on. But, and this is the important part, a lot of stuff that was not litigated in 2002 through 2008. A lot of that stuff, new stuff, came out. New allegations came out in this video, in this documentary, I should say. And that may have been too much. Within a week after the documentary came out, there were people in Chicago particularly clamoring for something to be done. And law enforcement, they said, well, we don't have any active investigations on him at this time. That ended up changing over time to the point that now he stands charged with offenses that could, in fact, have him locked up for 70 years, which is effectively the rest of his life since he's 52 now. Now, I could sit here and scratch my head and say to myself, like, what would possess a public, any public, to continue purchasing this man's music after, at a point, he was accused of essentially being a sexual predator. A predator, and again, I'm not accusing him of this, but there was certainly a great deal of evidence in the court of public opinion that this was a man who was had a thing for young girls and would do whatever he needed to do to be with young girls, and some say exploit young girls. There was an allegation in the documentary about some sort of cult that he ran and that people weren't free to come and go. I mean, it was all of that mess. And through it all, R. Kelly was still bankable. It reminds me to an extent of NFL football players who get accused of domestic violence. It's like, okay, you're accused, your team may drop you, but in a couple of cases this past football season, another team ended up picking people up. And again, these are people who were not convicted of crimes, but they were accused of these crimes. And, you know, I'm a big innocent until proven guilty kind of guy. And that includes R. Kelly. He is innocent until proven guilty. But I have to ask, what is the common thread between an R. Kelly and some football player who was alleged to have beaten up his wife, girlfriend, acquaintance, whatever? And the answer is, they're women. And the hard truth of that is that people don't always take allegations made by women seriously. I mean, I could put it more delicately, but this is just from my perspective. The common point between R. Kelly and all that he has been accused of, and the fact that it took a documentary, a film, to have him indicted. A film. That common point is the fact that women were making allegations, and for whatever sets of reasons, it didn't matter to people. It didn't matter to the people that bought R. Kelly's albums and singles and made him number one for a good stretch. It didn't matter. Should it have mattered? I mean, maybe I'm not the one to say, because I have never owned a piece of R. Kelly's music. I haven't. I've heard it a few times on the radio or, you know, with friends or whatever. But I was never, like, bowled over enough with R. Kelly to say, I got to go get that. And those who know me, and most of you don't, but those of you who do know me know that if I like a piece of music, I hunt it down like I'm hunting. You know, I'm an African wild dog hunting a wildebeest. I have to have that particular piece of music. That's why I've never been into streaming music, because I like to have an iTunes playlist that belongs to me, that I can access anytime I want and play any type of music I want. I mean, maybe streaming lets you do that, but from what I understand, it doesn't, like, you're not in physical possession of the music. But consider this about streaming and R. Kelly, to bring it back to him. After that documentary aired, okay, and this is amazing to me, his streams, according to Nielsen, almost doubled. Went from like 995,000 to 1.something million the week that the doc came out. Now, I don't know whether that's people being twisted, people being stupid, people not believing, you know, because R. Kelly has, throughout all this, asserted his innocence. He has always said, no, I never did any of these things. And given that he was acquitted on one set of counts, and given that he has not yet been convicted on the current counts, you have to say he's innocent until proven guilty. And I know that, you know, people, I don't care. You should. It is important. It is an important table leg in the foundation of our justice system that people are, in fact, considered innocent until they are proven guilty. And I don't know what's going to happen to R. Kelly. Seems like there's evidence. But for whatever reasons, I don't know how we turn off a, I don't know, moral light switch that says, hey, you know what? I'm not patronizing a guy who has, at the very least, a documented history of going in for young girls. Because I got a daughter, all right? And I don't, you know, I take the raising of my daughter very, very seriously. And I don't know what I would have done if a grown man had been intimate with my daughter when she was 15 years old. I'm wondering what you all would do, male or female, because it's not about gender. My thing is, no, not going to happen. And the fact of the matter is, and this is not to cast aspersions on the families of the women that R. Kelly allegedly exploited. You know, it's like these allegations go back, in some cases, 2 decades. R. Kelly's fate is now going to end up being in front of a jury. Are people still going to run out and buy his music? I want to thank you so much for listening to this podcast. The executive producer of The Intersection is Ms. Kim Jack Riley. Until we meet again, please be well.